Welcome to Risk Watch, a podcast brought to you by VCheck Global that sheds light on emerging compliance and due diligence issues affecting private market investors, financial institutions, and global corporations. I'm your host, Alex Soren. In this episode of the podcast, Amy Kayaza, a partner at Wilson Sonsini, came on the show to discuss the new proposed rules by FinCEN that would see a significant expansion of AML-CFT obligations for registered investment advisors, venture capital advisors, and private fund advisors. This could mean a significant addition to advisors' obligations when screening potential investors. You can find a link in the show notes to recent alert that the firm published on the proposed rules, as well as a link to Amy's bio and contact information. I had a great time talking with her, and I hope you enjoy the show. Okay, we're live. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So to kick things off, can you recap what FinCEN is proposing in terms of expanding AML-CFT obligations when it comes to registered investment advisors and exempt reporting advisors?
Yeah, absolutely. So historically, investment advisors have not been included in the definition of a financial institution. Financial institutions under the Bank Secrecy Act are required to conduct AML screening and, you know your customer type screening to make sure that there's no money laundering involved in a transaction. Investment advisors, as I said, have been kept out of that. What's proposed now by FinCEN would be to include both registered investment advisors and what are known as exempt reporting advisors within the AML regime, meaning for the first time they would be responsible for conducting their own AML screening, for having policies and procedures in place, and for making certain reports to FinCEN and to the federal government generally when they come across any kind of suspicious activity and the like. So this would be a really big sea change for the investment advisor regime.
And what are some real world examples of who's a RIA and who's an ERA?
So registered investment advisors are generally all kinds of asset managers, but the ones that most people are familiar with are kind of the Fidelities and the JP Morgans, and even some online robo-advisors like Betterman and the like have investment advisors affiliated with them. Exempt reporting advisors really only advise certain types of private funds, either venture capital funds or just small private funds, and are subject to a much lighter regulatory regime for the most part, where they do some pretty light reporting to the federal government, but don't have the full panoply of substantive regulation that registered advisors are subject to.
And could an ERA be an actual private equity firm or venture capital firm?
Yeah, that's what they would be. Then they would manage funds that are venture capital funds, private equity funds, private funds.
Great. So how pervasive, in your opinion, is the risk of bad actors such as sanctioned individuals, corrupt officials, people who represent a national security risk? How pervasive or significant is that risk of them investing in U.S. assets, securities, or companies?
Personally, I think the risk is pretty low for the most part. And there are a couple reasons for that. One is that most of the time, if an asset manager is managing money, there's another party like a bank or a broker involved in the money flow. And if so, there are all kinds of the Bank Secrecy Act, which requires AML screening, already governs those third-party institutions, the bank or the broker-dealer. And so it's not as if the money is flowing in and out of the asset manager's accounts without some other entity involved that might do the screening. Especially for exempt reporting advisors and fund advisors, sometimes there may not be a broker-dealer involved. There will be a bank involved. But a lot of the types of assets that a private equity or venture capital fund advisor is managing are extremely illiquid. And so you invest in their fund and you kind of sit there for a long time. If you think about a venture capital fund, it invests in venture capital investments. And the idea is that 5, 7, 10 years out, there's an IPO or something that produces your returns. That is a really inefficient way to launder money, 100%. And so it just doesn't seem like, especially in that case, that the types of investments that are being managed are likely to attract anyone who's seeking to launder money. It would be a really bad way to do it, basically.
And what about the piece of bad actors accessing sensitive technologies? Why is that potentially not that big of a risk if you know about how these things work?
Yeah, so FinCEN is concerned that investors in these funds are going to ask for sensitive information that would be problematic from a national security viewpoint. That's really not consistent with how most of these funds operate. Usually the investors in venture capital funds and private equity funds, other types of private funds, have pretty limited informational rights. It's the asset manager that knows the most about those underlying companies. And typically, the amount of information that then flows to investors is limited to information about sort of the stage of the company, what it does, what its returns are, but not proprietary, confidential information that is sensitive and very specific to the day-to-day operations of that underlying company. They don't want to spread that information around, and it's really just not an easy way for somebody to learn about what's going on in various portfolio companies.
So what would be a hypothetical scenario that FinCEN foresees?
Well, so FinCEN is concerned, for example, that you might have a Chinese investor that invests in a venture capital fund. And through that, the Chinese investor can find out about, say, an AI-based company that is doing all kinds of really cutting-edge and sensitive things, that access to the information could advantage somehow Chinese investor, maybe the Chinese government, and they find out about sensitive information that way. Or maybe the underlying portfolio company is doing defense contracting, that you know your investors could somehow find out about the sensitive things that the defense contracting company is doing. It's just really not consistent with how most of these funds operate, if any of them. Your limited partner in a fund is not, you know, sitting on the floor of a factory trying to understand exactly what's going on a day-to-day basis. So that's why this really is not an efficient or all that likely way that national security information is going to be discovered. There's a second overlay here, which is that AML screening is really not supposed to be about national security issues. It's supposed to be about laundering money. And so to the extent that FinCEN is concerned about sensitive information getting out, there are other regulatory regimes that deal with that. CFIUS, for example, which is about foreign investors investing in sensitive U.S. companies, is designed to really be the major regime through which we keep information from flowing to the wrong people. That's not the focus of AML practices and AML policies, and it just doesn't really make a whole lot of sense if that's the concern to impose AML policies.
Could it be that they foresee a scenario where just learning about a potential technology that a company is developing or is going to be bringing to market is enough of a starting point for a bad actor to then engineer some sort of attack or stealing of information?
I suppose they could, but there would be a lot of gaps in what they know, and there would be a lot they would have to do in addition to that to have it be an effective way to learn sensitive information. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that highly illiquid investment in a fund is even the best way to find out about these types of companies. There's all kinds of information about them that is probably only slightly less private in, you know, the press and in the, you know, trade press and the like. It just, you know, if you're really just identifying companies and identifying technology, you don't need to invest in a fund to do that. And so it just doesn't seem to be the right way to attack that kind of question.
Mm-hmm. So despite the low risks and the points that you've made that are very clear to me, it does seem that there's some real momentum behind this, despite FinCEN trying and failing for the past 20 years to pass something like this. So it'd be helpful if you can shed some context as to why that is, and if you do think there's a good chance that this might happen.
I think the burden that this is putting on investment advisors and even on investors who might be seeking to invest in funds is going to be really significant. It's going to cost a lot of money. It's going to probably result in higher minimum investments and in more obstacles to investing by your investors who are not super, super wealthy. And in that sense, I think what it ignores is what the potential consequences are going to be on the market. And so, yes, there may be some momentum here, but I think it's not recognizing that it might close off the market for this type of investing for a lot of investors in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
That was a little bit off point from your question, by the way, but
no, it's fine.
Really helpful.
So part of the AML CFT program that FinCEN's proposing would require ongoing customer due diligence, but at the same time, right now it's not requiring a customer identification program, including for legal entity customers. That would mean identifying the ultimate beneficial owner. Kind of seems like flawed due diligence to me. You know, what are the expectations for customer due diligence without the identification program?
It's a really good question, you know, and query how you can, in fact, conduct real AML procedures if you don't know exactly who someone is and who their beneficial owners are. I mean, I think it works better on an individual than it does on an entity. But where we have entities, that's where it's relatively easy to hide sort of several layers of ownership. It's probably higher risk. You know, I think especially if the real concern here is about national security type issues as opposed to money laundering per se, it would make much more sense to start with the CFT or the CIP practices, because that's where you could actually address those types of issues in a way that's much less burdensome. You know, maybe you find out who the owners are and you make sure they are who they say they are, but you don't necessarily have to go through the particulars of an AML policy. And, you know, I agree with you. This is perhaps putting the cart before the horse that way. And starting with an expansion of the TIP program would probably make much more sense.
Mm-hmm. But even when it comes to national security risk and really understanding who the potential investor is and who might be behind the investor, that's not burdensome. So in your mind, you know, how prepared are ERAs in particular to conduct, you know, what we would refer to as enhanced due diligence on potential investors?
Probably not very. I think, you know, most of these advisors are already doing a very basic level of KYC, which is required under the OFAC regime, the Office of Foreign Assets Control. That's already required of absolutely everybody. So you have to know who the person is and you need to run to make sure that they're not, you know, a Russian oligarch that we can't do business with or something like that. Beyond that, I mean, many of these kind of venture capital and private fund advisors are not, they're, as I said, relatively lightly regulated. They don't have the same level of procedures that a big asset manager would. And the cost of this is probably going to be pretty burdensome, both in terms of money and in terms of time. Because as you said, especially if you have to sort of reach back several layers to figure out who the ultimate owner is of an organization, that can take a lot of time. It causes a lot of friction to investors. It requires documentation, record keeping, all kinds of, you know, potential, maybe not an investigation, but confirmations by getting documentation from your investors. I think it really will increase the cost to these advisors, and especially, as you said, the exempt reporting advisors who advise just funds in a way that really could change the nature of the industry. It's also really arguably not consistent with how Congress thought about regulation of exempt reporting advisors. Private fund advisors and venture capital advisors were specifically exempted from full registration as advisors by Congress. That's a different regulatory regime, but the idea was generally that these types of advisors are not necessarily, should not necessarily be covered by significant substantive regulation. By imposing this new set of regulations, you know, it really does change the nature of the business, of how these advisors operate, and what their regulatory costs are going to be. And that can be a really significant burden.
Mm-hmm. There was some ominous language in the proposed rules that my reading of it was, you know, you better get ready for this. And with that, you know, with that being said, what would be your advice to investment advisors when they are going to be taking on potential capital from, you know, a new investor that might be considered high risk? What are some things they can do, you know, right now to make sure they have their ducks in a row?
Well, they can start, I think, looking at the agreements that they have with investors. You know, most of those agreements, you know, give an advisor the ability to ask for information from their investors, you know, just to confirm who they are and the like. Probably that language has to be beefed up. They're probably going to have to start thinking a little bit more seriously about what kind of documentation they're getting from their investors to confirm who they are and what their beneficial ownership is. Record keeping, I think, around these issues could be significant, especially because there's both civil and criminal liability associated with AML screening. You know, beyond that, something that a lot of banks and brokers do that advisors could consider doing is, you know, working with third parties to do some of the screening and contractually delegating some of that work. That adds financial costs, and it doesn't necessarily get rid of the liabilities. You're still responsible for what happens. But especially if you're already partnered with, say, a bank or a broker-dealer, and they're doing significant AML screening of the investors that are coming into your funds, you know, you may be able to kind of rely on what they're doing that may be a more cost-effective way to deal with these kinds of scenarios. And it's probably more realistic for a fully registered advisor than a fund advisor who's an exempt reporting advisor. But it's another way to think about attacking the problem, you know, once regulation is passed.
Great. Well, this has been really, really helpful and interesting. If anyone's interested in getting in touch, your contact information will be in the show notes, as well as a link to your bio and the alert that you and the firm put out on this subject. So thanks again for coming on and appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.